Produced by Jeffrey Griselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall, this is Yes Music Podcast episode 455. What did they do next? Part 17b, Billy Sherwood.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 455 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. Mark and I are back this week with the second part of our look at the world trade album Euphoria in our What Did They Do Next series. This time, of course, it's Billy Sherwood. We also have a chance to give our two pence on a topic which compares Roger Dean's approach to that of Yes themselves. I hope you find all that interesting. Notable highlights this week around the social medias, and beginning specifically with the YMP Facebook page, included Freya Dean promoting the Secret Path podcast with her dad Roger, and Preston Frazier mentioning that last week would have been Billy's brother Mike Sherwood's birthday. Preston also reviews In a World of Our Own from Heaven and Earth, which he thinks is pleasant enough, and Dave Watkinson visited the Roger Dean exhibition at Trading Boundaries, which I imagine has now had to be closed for England's lockdown. A great shame, because it looks beautiful as always. Forbes.com had an interview with Jeff Downes and Alan White, in which Alan seems to confirm that recording has been happening through lockdown, with files being passed around the band members, as pointed out by Daniel Crone. And Mark updated his latest album project with both an interview with another of his bass players, Mr. Lee ARW Pomeroy, and 80% of that new album being played on the Check It Out show with DJ Peter Prog. Excellent name. Yes, historians Henry Potts and Aymeric Leroy, hope that's how you pronounce the name, were on a podcast talking all about the world's greatest progressive rock band. And remember, there was supposed to be a Yes virtual interview hosted by John Kirkman. Well, according to the always reliable sources Brian Neeson and the aforementioned Henry Potts, there were technical difficulties, but it will appear soon. So, looking forward to that. Paul Watson spotted John Kirkman's recollections of his meetings with Chris Squire. And in the community posts, and yes, you guessed it, there were several from Geoffrey Mason. Here's the list. Contemporary interviews with and articles about Rick Wakeman's Six Wives and Journey to the Centre of the Earth. Billy Idol's Guitarist's Guitar Hero Revealed. Guess who that is? A Rolling Stone article which purports to be about Steve Howe. Downbeat Review's review of The Royal Affair Tour Live. Adverts for Yesterdays and the Myths and Tales of King Arthur. A whole band interview from the Meraz era. Edge of Prog's interview with Steve Howe about his latest solo album Love Is. A video of Mind Drive, more about Rick's Place video service, news from bravewords.com on the new Flower Kings album, and Hawkstrawl's new, is that how you pronounce their name? Hawkestrawl. New Christmas album, which features Rick Wakeman. Crikey. Tony Handley added a photo of his very early preparations for the YMP 10th anniversary live recording on top of Yes Tour in Devon. Remember, you are most welcome to attend yourself in August of next year. And Chris Karam posted Chris Squire's setlist from West Palm Beach, in which one word from each song is replaced with the same scatological term. Over on Twitter, I posted a photo of my brand new Blu-ray version of Chris Squire's Fish Out of Water, as well as my vinyl copies of the last three Yes live albums. And Joost Magliff added his copy of Euphoria by World Trade. Brian Harris got in touch this week with a very considered reaction to the Royal Affair Tour Live. You may have seen what he said on Facebook. It's well worth a read, as are the comments from last episode's show notes from Joost Magliff and Dave Watkinson. As always, thank you very much indeed to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week. World Trade Euphoria. The first song on this album, One World Going Round, opens with some atmospheric percussion effects and then a screeching electric guitar solo which explores some tones before keyboard appears and then a Wakeman start of Awaken-esque descending piano passage. It's an intriguing and tantalising start. Suddenly the mood shifts with acoustic guitar and voice appearing. A sweet ballad-style melody with a great bass line well up in the mix. I like the anthemic chorus and the vocals are treated in a similar way to some on Open Your Eyes. It's a slow-moving song, but engrossing nonetheless. Lyrics talk about the future of mankind, and the message is one of hope. A very encouraging opening to the album, with plenty of accomplished instrumental work featuring all players equally. The second song, Dark Sky, again pushes Sherwood's bass to the front, which suits me, and there's a mechanical industrial feel this time. It's another slow beat, and Billy's vocals are deliberately hidden low in the mix. Vocals show the influence Sherwood was to have on Yes in the near future, and electric guitar soloing is rocky but well integrated into the soundscape. It's a masterful production job, actually. Everything feels like it fits. A middle section pushes the music into a more frenetic and tonally interesting place for a time, before returning to the original groove. There's plenty to discover in this complex texture, and overall, it's a brooding dark piece, as the title would suggest. Billy's vocals are strong and characterful, which is maybe why he kept being chased by bands like Yes, and much later Asia, to lead the singing there. His is not in any way an Anderson-like voice, of course, and I'm not sure that could have worked, but here it certainly does. The third title is Evolution Song, or Evolution Song, whichever you prefer, and this one is written by Messrs. Sherwood and Squire. Chris also lends bass and vocals to the recording. Even slower than the first two songs, this one starts as if at sunrise on a quiet river or something. Squire's bass is clearly there, and the line is very similar to the approach on the first two songs. That's not a bad thing. After all, Sherwood followed very much in his master's footsteps. There are shades of Open Your Eyes, and Squire's backing singing is lovely to hear. It's a fairly straight-ahead rock song with a good electric guitar solo and an almost continuous repeating bass line. A mix of peaceful song with a lot of vocal and instrumental insistence. I think it might take me some time to get used to its style, despite the definitely fine musicianship. It's certainly one to listen to again. Golden Age is next, and it segues in from the end of Evolution Song. Here we have a much more up-tempo romp penned by brothers Michael and Billy Sherwood. A pulsating bass line pins down a high-energy song, with its roots in the 1980s perhaps, with some blistering lead and harmony vocals in a head-nodding fiesta. Much shorter than the first three songs, maybe this was earmarked as a single, the mobile bass line whets the appetite for what Billy may be able to bring to new Yes music, and this song is a blast. It's the end of the golden age, sings Billy. Hopefully not. The Wake of the Storm opens, with some great piano work again echoing a Wakeman approach a little. Spangly guitars and a powerful vocal line appear, and then a full rock band groove hits, with quite an impact. Jay Shellen's solid drumming is ideal, and big rock bass and solo electric guitar carry us on relentlessly. It's a highly immersive mix, with committed performances. Is this really Sherwood on lead vocals? If so, he packs quite a punch. A huge wall of sound approach, which could be a little too dense, but actually manages to keep enough motion and interest going to avoid this entirely. A little foreshadowing of songs like The Solution from Open Your Eyes are evident, but this music just works really well, particularly the inclusion of piano, which adds a different kind of layer. Of course, Open Your Eyes, which I can't help referencing, didn't have a full-time keyboard player, and maybe that's why I like this music a little bit more than some of that Yes album. The song finishes with some remarkable guitar soloing, which warps and distorts. In Your Mind is next. A little more up-tempo than the previous number, but just as powerful. This song grabs you by the throat and doesn't let go, with more towering bass and crisp drums beneath searing lead and harmony vocals. Again, this could be an overwhelming tapestry of sound, but manages to be engaging and rewarding instead. There's a strut and a sense of poise to the music, which is infectious. Another longer song at just over 6 minutes, it rocks along and the chorus is catchy. There's a much more contemplative section which employs a range of effects and fragmentary drumming, which makes the song more than just a bang and a bash. Perhaps it's time for a different approach, though, and the next song on the album is certainly shorter at 3 minutes and 46 seconds. Not the Only One has a strong melodic vocal line backed by a fine chorus of harmony singing. While not a lot lighter in texture, it does have contrasting passages of more transparent instrumentation, which makes a nice change. An attractive song. The title song is next, Euphoria. This starts with heavily distorted guitar, I think, and then Jay Shellen brings in a robust beat. Actually, I've just realised his snare sound is a bit Bruford-esque. Billy's bass line on this up-tempo romp is again brilliant as it moves around almost the whole instrument and keeps the energy and motion high. Vocals are also very strong and the chorus catchy. The band sound like they're having a lot of fun with this one, and it transfers to the listener as well. There's a fast and furious guitar solo, at least I think it's guitar, it's heavily treated again, and the whole song nips along in a highly attractive manner. A real head nodder and a fine way to remind us of the name of the album. The production of this song, and actually the whole album, seems less muddy to me than Open Your Eyes. Say Goodbye is the second and final Chris Squire collaboration on the record. The strong and attractive vocal line which opens the song makes me assume this is going to be a ballad. This is reinforced by some picked acoustic guitar and lovely Squire bass swoops. The lyrics contain an impassioned plea to save the world through our actions, and it's a very attractive song with a great set of instrumental parts, some dramatic hiatus moments, and of course, fantastic Squire bass. It shifts up and away from its quieter opening to feature electric soloing and a robust feel, and the harmony backing singing, complete with Squire in the mix, is a great addition. This is definitely a song to play repeatedly. It's affirmative and contains a lot more interesting elements than might be apparent at first listen. Top quality rock music. There's another direct segue into One by One by One, which turns into a bit of a prog-tastic epilogue to the previous song for its 1 minute 35 second duration. A restrained but perfectly constructed piece of experimentation, which does nudge the music to a more progressive place. Sounds good to me. It fades out to reveal the opening of the final song, and the longest, the almost 10-minute-long Wheels of Life. A weird and wonderful keyboard passage leads to sci-fi effects, and then a fragmented vocal and instrumental declaration. It's a very complex and interesting mix of approaches and false endings. Suddenly a repeating bass line appears amid more vocal effects and instrumental maelstrom, until more and more experimentation is thrown in. It feels like an oral playground, with all sorts of different approaches combined and fragments thrown about. Highly engaging and endlessly fascinating stuff. If a little difficult to get a handle on initially, there's so much fabulous playing and singing which combines in unusual and unexpected ways that you can't take your ears off it. The ingenuity is remarkable, and there are probably enough ideas for another complete album, but actually it all works together well, rather than being too packed and jumping from place to place uncomfortably. It's properly progressive, in a way I've not experienced before. It's also interesting that the effects used don't seem too tied into the technology of the time. It's clearly mostly electronic, but in a way it's a 1995 reimagining of some of the early 70s studio experimentation. More electronic than tape and razor blades, but equally as interesting for me. The song and album completes with a fade-out and last hanging-on Sherwood lyric. There's a lot more to discover in this album than I was expecting. It's packed with interesting songs and approaches and feels like a very mature and creative band of musicians, clearly enjoying exploring a lot of different avenues. It is predominantly rock music, but with more than enough variation and progressive elements to make it worthy of many listens and deep investigation.
Greetings, friends. So this week we're doing another episode of What Did They Do Next? A few weeks ago, we took a look at World Trade Euphoria, just giving everybody our first thoughts on it. But this week we're going to be going a little bit more in depth with it. To be honest, like I said a few weeks back, I had not heard this record ever before in its entirety. In fact, I don't think I heard pretty much any of it, to be quite honest. So I did go ahead and order the album on CD, and luckily I did get it a few days ago and gave it a very, very thorough listen. And I have to say that I was not disappointed. Being a big fan of the very first World Trade record, I had high hopes for this record. But you know how it is. The first album was done with, I think, Keith Olsen. They had a big budget. They were on a big label. This record is done through Magna Carta, I believe, which is a sort of large indie label. It was done by Billy Sherwood. Now, keep in mind, this record came out in 1995, so it's a very young Billy Sherwood still, not as experienced in the world of production as he would be nowadays. So all these things kind of came into mind when I was getting ready to listen to this. But I got to say, for a record that was done in 1995, the first thing that I'm going to say about this record is it has aged extremely well. I would not know listening to this that it was done in 1995. I think the production is just fantastic on this. My hat's off to Billy. The drums sound great. The guitar sounds that are on here are really well done and produced. There's some fantastic 12-string and clean electric tones. The distorted guitars are really well done. I love the production done on the vocals. I mean, everything on here is great. Even Chris Squire, who appears on two songs on this record, Evolution Song and Say Goodbye. I mean, it just sounds great on here, his bass playing. So again, as I usually do, I'm not going to go into great detailed song by song. I usually let Kevin do that. But I'm going to pick out a couple of songs I thought were really good and make a few comments about them. The opening song, One World Going Round, is really good. It's a very strong opener. It's not your usual opener in that. It's not one of these very hard-hitting, fast, upbeat songs. It's very Big Generator-ish influenced, yes. Lots of atmospheric vocals. You know, this album has a lot of effect on it. Delay, reverb, and not in a bad way. I think it really makes the vocals sound really fantastic on here. The guitar sounds and those kind of sounds sound very Yes-like, but very Trevor Rabin era-ish. It's not a Steve Howe sort of Yes sound, which is good because if they would have went down that route, I think that might have made it a bit more dated. I think the Trevor Rabin approach in this made it sound less dated, that's for certain. Dark Sky is another great one with some great 12-string guitar. The bass and drums on here are extremely tight. I mean, that's another thing about this record I have to say is that the interplay between Jay Shallon on drums and Billy on bass is really good. I mean, if you don't have a solid bass and drum section on a record, then all hope is kind of lost, if you ask me, because that's the foundation of a good song. And the vocals, very well done, great singing, and some interesting tricks that he incorporated on here. For example, in the verses, he panned his vocal only to the left side, which is something that you don't really expect to hear. That's something that's, you know, like a 60s production trick that they used to do, like with the Beatles, vocals on one side, music on the other side sort of thing. But yeah, it worked very well because it's not overused. Evolution Song is the first song we have Chris Squire on. Plays very well on this. He doesn't overplay at all. Some very good drum sounds. I think the snare drum, for example, on this song is really, really well recorded. I mean, you can literally like hear the snares on the bottom of the drum on this one. I mean, it almost sounds like on headphones, like it's right in front of you. That's a sign of a great production job. And also the keyboards in the song are really, really well thought out. The sounds are really, they really stand out, the sounds of them, but not so much that it distracts from the rest of the music. I think that's very important. If you pick out a sound on a keyboard that's very like abrasive, or if it's too like noticeable, like every time you hit a note on it, you're like, wow, what the hell is that? It kind of distracts you from the rest of the song. I think this keyboard sound that he uses is noticeable enough to kind of, you know, perk up your ears for a second, but not so much that you lose track of the whole song. Another great example of good production work there. The Wake of the Storm is another great song. Great piano introduction. I've become lately a very big fan of piano within the prog rock genre. Not that I haven't been before, but for some reason I've just gotten more into piano overall. And this is a great example of a nice piano part at the beginning. Then afterwards we have a nice clean guitar coming in. And once again, Billy Sherwood's vocals on this are really good. And the guitar soloing on this record is very good. Obviously influenced again by the sort of Trevor Rabin era, yes. Things like, you know, heavy whammy bar use, some tapping, and, you know, things, techniques that you would not hear Steve Howe do in his Yes are apparent in this sort of music that they're doing now. Obviously, again, being that they're all big Yes fans. And obviously two of them are in Yes now, Jay Shallon and Billy Sheehan. So obviously the influence is noticeable in a very early part of their career. So, you know, I can say a lot about the other songs. I mean, every song on this record is very good. The one thing that I've noticed about this as I listened to it a couple of times is that this album has a really good mix of prog rock and AOR rock. I think that combination, most people roll their eyes at the mention of AOR rock. I don't, because if it's done tastefully, it's something that just is enjoyable to listen to as any other kind of genre in the rock scene. But this combination is good. The prog rock gives it that sort of interesting dynamic with the technical playing, and the AOR rock gives it that more sense of melody, the more sense of sort of the commercial end of things, which I think benefits a lot of these songs. I think it really gives it a nice blend. And to be honest, I think that's the reason why this album has aged so well. Oh, and one last thing I have to mention. The closer, Wheels of Life, is a great song, epic song. Every sort of progressive sort of songwriting trick is in there. You know, all kinds of technical things here and there and start, stop parts, and you just name it. But the one thing that I found very interesting that made me smile is the bass sound here is very reminiscent of Tormato. It has that sort of wah harmonized bass effect on there that I'm sure when Kevin heard that probably put a smile on his face. So overall, I gotta say, I really enjoyed this record. I've been listening to it quite a bit, and I think I'm going to continue to listen to it because I really think it's a great album. I hope one day they decide to put it on vinyl. I mean, no, that's probably a long shot, but I think it's a record that could do very well. I mean, also, the reason why it may not go on vinyl is because it is rather long. It is an hour-long record, and 30 minutes aside on a single vinyl would not be probably advisable. And whether a label like Magna Carta would be willing to do a double vinyl release of this, who knows, but never say never. So let's go over to Kevin and talk about this further.
A very enjoyable week listening to Euphoria by Billy Sherwood's, one of his first bands, I suppose, World Trade. And Mark is with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
I'm not doing too badly today, thank you. We've got some nice weather here. What about you?
Oh, actually, we've been going through some very, very warm weather. It's very shocking. We're up into like almost 20 degrees Celsius temperature here.
Crikey. Blimey. And can you do an instant calculation into Fahrenheit for that?
Low, high 70s, I think.
Crikey. That's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, the Fahrenheit thing doesn't mean anything to me. But anyway, let's get back to the music.
Okay.
Excellent. So, yes, a very young Billy Sherwood. And on this record, you can hear it in his voice, can't you? I mean, to be honest, I really didn't recognise his singing voice here. It's quite different from today, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm guessing it wasn't done like, it wasn't one of these things where, you know, I'm going to sing in a different voice for this record. It was just probably one of these things where, you know, his voice changes as he, you know, gets older. And because we became so used to Billy with Yes, that by that point, his voice had already kind of matured and deepened a bit. But at this point, you know, it's no wonder that they were looking at him this early for, you know, Yes to replace John for singing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because he puts in a fantastic performance on bass and on vocals on this record, I think. And he mixed it as well. He produced it himself, which I think is an amazing achievement. And this must have been one of his earliest production efforts.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the record before this one, I believe Keith Olsen, the very popular Keith Olsen, was in charge of all those things, production and mixing. And if I'm not mistaken, Billy did mention once that it was one of those eye-opening experiences where he learned quite a bit. And it's probably obvious because he did a great job mixing this album.
Yeah, yeah, it really does sound great. And call me biased, but I love how much bass there is on it. And perhaps it was the way I was listening to it, but it really does come through. Was that your experience as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, Billy Sherwood's never made any bones about the fact that he is highly influenced by Chris. And, you know, Chris is on the record as well. So, yes. I mean, if you're going to have Chris Squire on your record, you know, you're gonna have to try to, you know, be at least try to be on similar playing fields as far as, you know, volume and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right. And it certainly does benefit from that, I think. It really sounds great. And it's fascinating, isn't it, that, as you said in your piece, perhaps they had less budget, but they've certainly put their creative thinking caps on, haven't they? I mean, it strikes me as a very creative, a very ingenious, a very explorative type record where they haven't stuck to any formulas or whatever. They really have tried to mix it up and do something different on this, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the benefits of their age, because I remember a fantastic interview that I heard with Neil Peart once when they were in their early 30s saying that they were at the age where they were old enough to be good at their instruments and their songwriting, mm-hmm. but young enough to still be open to new things and to explore and to experiment. And I think that's showing in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly on that epic last song, which we'll come on to in a minute. And that, yeah, your comments about Big Generator did interest me as well. And also, I couldn't stop hearing Open Your Eyes in there. And it's not surprising because it wasn't that long after this. And it was material that Sherwood and Squire were working on together, which filled up certainly a good part of Open Your Eyes. And it was then it was worked on by the others in the band, of course. But I certainly can hear Open Your Eyes in this. But what I thought here that you don't have, which Big Generator does, is there's always that intention, I think, with Trevor Rabin to create catchy sing-along melodies and big tunes. And this record doesn't really go for the same kind of territory, does it, in terms of big tunes and stadium-filling sing-alongs?
No, well, I mean, that's one thing where it is different. I mean, they don't have the as commercialized attempts at choruses, but I still find that their stuff is extremely catchy, at least for me. I mean, it may be different for others listening and maybe even for you, Kevin, but I find that the music still, to me, has a really good blend of sort of the prog rock. Yes. And there's a lot of AOR in this. It really is. There's a lot of this kind of album-oriented sort of rock where it's very much going around the melodies a lot. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like, you know, a scene all good people. It doesn't have to be so catchy and happy for it to be attractive and for it to be something that sticks in your mind. I was being sincere when I said that after I listened to this album a couple of times, I couldn't help but wanting to listen to it several times a day.
Yeah, I think it is that good. But tell us a bit more about AOR. Now, that's a term which I understand what it means, but what bands do you think typify AOR and why do you think it has a bit of a bad name?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, you usually have bands like Toto and, you know, sometimes they have like, I've seen even bands like what was that band? Like Air Supply and like this having these kind of, you know, attachments to it. But it's, I don't know. I mean, let's put it this way. When bands got called like punk, you know, some people didn't like that term being assessed to them. There was a lot of bands that didn't like being called, let's say, even heavy metal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I
think the whole thing with it is that people feel that there's too much of a specific thing to it. Like album-oriented rock is pretty much defined as American FM radio format focusing on album tracks by rock artists.
Right.
So basically, it's good. Like they're not going for singles. This is more like they're going for more deeper cuts off the albums. And you know what? For me, I think that's fine because, you know, sometimes I get kind of sick of the singles and, you know, another example of that is a band like Foreigner. You know, a lot of the they have a lot of hit singles, but they also have a lot of songs within their catalog that fans of their music love, maybe even more than the singles themselves.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And these labels in the end become meaningless, don't they? Because the album oriented rock is precisely what I would have thought that Yes were doing. For most of their career, they were focusing on the albums, not on singles. But you would never describe, well, maybe you would, but you wouldn't describe the main sequence of Yes albums as album-oriented rock, I wouldn't have thought. And it feels a bit sort of middle of the road, and that's certainly not what this record is.
No, not at all. I mean, I don't know. There's something about this record that I find extremely fascinating because they did a record before this one with Keith Olsen that obviously had that push to have commercial radio accessible songs to it. But I think that even by this point, Billy was probably thinking to himself that they don't want to be labeled as a, you know, hit band only.
Yes.
They wanted to be much more than that. I mean, hence their love of Yes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, Yes didn't give two hoots about, you know, making, you know, top 10 singles. They just wanted to make music that they loved. And I think that rubbed off on them. And hence, you have a record here that has so many great songs on there and so many different, you know, feels and moods and soundscapes. It's fantastic. I really enjoy this record.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Wheels of Life, because that struck me definitely as progressive, not in the same way as something like Talk, which was, of course, immediately preceded this, and not in the same way as, you know, Close to the Edge, etc., but progressive in the sense that it really pushes the music into some very strange places, doesn't it? I mean, there are bits and pieces that you can latch hold of, but mostly it's a bit of an exploration, isn't it, of sound. It's definitely not commercial at all. And 10 minutes of this song, it's such a crazy amount of stuff going on in it.
Yeah, and I mean, the funny thing is, just to go back for 1 second to that AOR bit, when you look at the definitions on, like, Wiki, it says here, like, AOR evolved from hard rock and progressive rock radio in the mid-70s using research and formal programming to create an album rock format with greater commercial appeal. So it's like they were trying to take album cuts and give them a more commercial view. You know what I mean? To it. And like Wheels of Life, for example, is probably one of those songs that, you know, it kind of falls out of that bracket because of its length. But if Wheels of Life was like 4 minutes or 5 minutes, it could easily fall into that bracket. But one of the things that immediately hit me about that song, which I thought would have tickled your fancy for sure, was there was a very Tormato-ish sounding bass sound in that song. Like, it really reminded me of that, you know, that kind of wobbly wah harmonic bass that he had in, like, you know, Silent Wings of Freedom or stuff, something like that.
Yes,
you know?
yes. And once you said that, and once I listened to your piece and you said that, then it made a lot of sense to me why I like this so much. But it's a really complex piece. I don't want to go on about it too much, but it is complex. And, you know, the amount of sci-fi noises in there, and as you said, it hasn't dated. So they've obviously got it right in terms of the effects and the sounds that they've used, because it doesn't seem to have dated and doesn't seem to be stuck in the early 1990s as it could have been. I just think it's a remarkable piece of work. I'd like to hear Billy talking about it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one thing that honestly shocked me the more I listened to this record, is how little this album has dated. And that is really, really tough to do, because especially in the late 80s, you know, there was a tendency to use different kinds of reverbs a certain kind of reverb that definitely pinned it to that time period, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even in those 80s period, you know, Phil Collins' drum sound was very popular to use. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of emphasis on over-reverbing things and stuff. And you know what? They made their sound interesting, very... ear candy-ish, but not something where you can say, oh my God, listen to that 1980s snare drum there, Kevin. It sounds terrible, doesn't it? You know, it's one of those things where, and you had mentioned it yourself, you said that there was moments in there that remind you of like a Bill Bruford-ish snare drum sound. Yeah. And I really liked it because it was a very natural sound.
Yes. I did think the production on the drums was particularly good. And as you pointed out, the bass and drum combination there of Jay Schellen and Billy Sherwood was, you know, a sign of the future, wasn't it? It was a foretelling of things to come. And of course, the other development from this was Conspiracy itself. Can you hear Conspiracy in this? Conspiracy is not a band, I have to say, that I've listened to a huge amount.
Well, I mean, sure. I mean, any kind of project that Billy's involved with, there are things that are always present in it. I mean, even to records that he's done now.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that band I keep harping on about with people, Between the Stations, that Billy just produced. And there's elements of it there. Something that you can hear on Euphoria, you can hear something now in 2020. I mean, whether it's his approach on production of bass sounds, whether it's the way he approaches his songwriting. And just to give a little small plug, if you don't mind, the next Project Gemini update video that I'm doing.
Yeah.
I have an interview with Billy Sherwood that I did.
Yes.
And on there, we talk about these kind of things, like his approach to, you know, working on songs and production. And that'll probably give further insight as to what I'm talking about here, as far as, you know, things that have went from project to project to project, that gives it that kind of connection.
Absolutely. And if you think about any producer, any artist, really, you can hear their signatures, I suppose, in almost every piece that they do. I mean, certainly someone like John Anderson, you know, absolutely, not just because of the timbre of his voice, but because of the way he writes things. And you can hear the Thousand Hands Part One, you can hear echoes of music that he wrote right back in the early 70s. It's not quite like Elias, of course, that's not what I'm saying at all, but you certainly do know that it's John Anderson. And in the same way here, you know, this is Billy Sherwood, but very enjoyable indeed. And, you know, it does show you the roots of quite a bit of music that came after that. And I did enjoy it very much listening to that this week, as you did, I think, Mark. And please do have your own say on this, though. On the show notes for this week, leave us a comment. What do you think of this album? What do you think of World Trade and the other albums? What do you know about that? Excellent stuff. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin. This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrein.
So with a bit of a link to talking about Billy Sherwood, we're going to have a bit of a Two Pence this week. Mark is still with me. Hello again.
Hello there, Kevin.
So here's the statement. Yes, and other classic bands should do what Roger Dean does, and that is give the fans what they are expecting. So this is because, Mark, trading boundaries. Now, we've just gone into lockdown in the UK, so in England. So I'm assuming that the Trading Boundaries annual exhibition of Roger Dean's work has actually had to close today. But we saw some photographs from it on Facebook, shared by various different people, including Keith Hoisington, one of our patrons, of course. And as we've just been saying about Billy Sherwood, Roger Dean is one of those artists who is instantly recognisable. You know, right across his career from the early 70s until now, you know you're looking at a piece of Roger Dean when you see it. So my question is, why is it that bands like Yes don't do the same thing? Why don't they just keep on producing great music, but music that is quite obviously tied to the rest of their catalogue?
This is a very, very interesting yet very touchy subject, I find, with people and with musicians especially, because to say, you know, why don't they do what the fans expect? I mean, people can say that AC/DC has done that for the last 25, 30 years.
Yep.
And have, you know, pretty much essentially released the same album for the last 25, 30 years. Now,
yes.
If you take that approach with Yes, there's two ways to look at this, I find. Doing something that fans expect. Now, what do fans expect? They expect progressive rock from Yes. Mm-hmm. They expect, you know, music that is catchy, but, you know, there's lots of things to it, lots of parts, lots of complicated changes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, clean guitar, acoustic guitar, all kinds of things in there. But yet people would say if they did that, they would be no better than AC/DC because they're doing the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, when they did something completely different, like, let's say, 90125, that in another way could be said as, you know, they're doing what the fans expect. They're expecting them to progress and to change.
Yeah.
Because that's what people loved about Yes back in the 70s. They didn't always do the same thing. Things, they kept moving forward. Even John Anderson said, after they did Fragile, the label wanted them to do another Fragile. They said, no, we can't do that. We have to keep going and just changing as we go.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's the question right there. That's what makes this difficult to sort of answer, is because what is it exactly that Yes fans are expecting? You know, are they expecting it to be, you know, let's write Close to the Edge for the next 20 years and then we'll be happy over and over again? Mm-hmm. Or are they expecting them to try new things and to, you know, try new technologies and stuff like that? Like, what's your feel on that?
Well, I'm just sitting here looking at my selection of Yes albums, which are outside the main sequence. Starting off with Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, Howe. They certainly tried some different things there. Whether you think that's Yes or not, let's, for the sake of argument, that's Yes. They certainly did try some different things there. The electronic stuff, but they were working together as a band, and it was different and it was new, but it was still identifiably the same artists, the same music. When you think about The Ladder, Magnification, those, well, particularly Magnification went in a different direction because of the orchestra. The Ladder, they were trying to make the best Yes album they could, as I always say. So they were different, but just as good in a different way, perhaps. Fly From Here, again, that was looking backwards and forwards, because I think that owed an awful lot to the production. But here's an interesting one. From a Page. Now, that was around the same time, of course, as Fly From Here. But actually, From a Page includes some music that I would say is exactly what I'm talking about here with the Roger Dean thing. That, for me, has all the hallmarks of great Yes music, from the keyboards of Oliver Wakeman and so on, and the guitar soloing of Steve Howe, and great bass lines and all that sort of thing. And yet it feels fresh and it feels a bit different. And on the other side of that is Heaven and Earth, which I think feels like something completely different and not especially my cup of tea. So what do you think about From a Page and how that might have continued, Yes, in a different way, but a way which is more connected to the past?
From a Page is exactly the example of something that I was trying to get to a few times before, which is that Oliver Wakeman did a great justice for people in the Yes world, because that album is probably one of my favorite releases that Yes has done in a long time.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's what I expect when I think of Yes music, and what I hope for when I think of new Yes music. And that's because, again, I think, you know, he's a bit in the younger stable of Yes people that are involved. He's also been a fan of Yes music. I mean, growing up with it, his father being involved in it, there's no way that he could get around that, right? And I think that's part of the problem here, is because, you know, as long as you have Steve Howe sort of leading the ship right now, he needs to let more of the younger people guide the ship now, I think. I know this is something that's very, you know, not taken too nicely by some of the Yes people out there listening, but I'm not trying to insult Steve by any stretch of the imagination, but he definitely needs to have outside people helping with the songwriting. People like, you know, Billy, people like Oliver. Yeah. I mean, when they're involved in the writing, because of their fanhood of the band, I think that they kind of know what the fans are clamoring for and know how to appease that part of it. And I think that that's proven with, you know, the record there that you just mentioned, you know? So I think that having those songs off of Fly From Here was a great mistake.
Hmm.
I think they should have ditched some of the other ones and left those ones on instead.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly think, and I know this is not going to go over well either, but if you were going to get rid of Oliver from the band for Jeff,
yep,
you should have at least kept Oliver in the picture for songwriting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Now, don't get me wrong, I am a huge supporter of Jeff. And I really like Fly From Here, always have done, and I've always said that I have done. I love Drama and everything that he's done for the band, and I think he's a fantastic musician, etc. But he brings something different to the writing, I think. And I think you can hear that on Heaven and Earth. And it's maybe not steeped, as you've just been saying, in the same way in the legacy of Yes music that Oliver Wakeman seemed to do on that From a Page, which is fascinating, isn't it? We started off this talking about Yes's future, and we ended up talking about Oliver Wakeman and From a Page. That's good. I like that. So yes, it's fascinating, isn't it? So, and the other thing which occurs to me is that Yes have done exactly what you would expect in their live albums. Okay, so,
yeah,
and I'm not sure that's a very great idea. As we said a few weeks ago, we've certainly got enough live albums now, I would say. However, having said that, I will certainly be purchasing the Relayer one, hopefully, when it comes out in next year, when, after I've seen that that concert, which I'm very much looking forward to that concert series. So that will be something. But again, that's a bit different. I think there is a trap with producing the same stuff, as you've just said. I mean, the bands, other bands that I can think of, like Coldplay, seem to do the same sort of thing again and again. Status Quo, the Rolling Stones, you know, they perhaps go too much the other way. But I'm drawn back to saying that From a Page, I really do think, got the balance right. So maybe, hopefully, fingers crossed, and we've been talking about World Trade and Billy Sherwood today as well, that is looking good for this, you know, rumours again floating around this week about writing and passing music between them during lockdown and so on. So we shall see. But certainly someone else who has definitely got it right is, I think, Roger Dean, because he's still producing the most wonderful Roger Dean paintings and artworks, and still so active and wonderful on the videos that he's producing all the time. So I think he's got the balance exactly right. And so let's just hope that Yes can do that as well with their next live album. But any last comments from you on that, Mark?
No, I think you summed it up pretty well. I mean, you know how I am. If I get on it, I'll be talking for another half an hour.
All right. Well, so you have your say on that as well on the show notes for this week, please. What do you think about that idea of doing the sorts of things that fans expect? Is that a good thing or a bad thing in painting or in music? But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Welcome to the Yes Music Podcast with Kevin Mulryan and Mark Anthony Kay.
Just before we go, here's half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall. And half of those Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark James Lang, Martin Kelberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Obate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkol-Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington, William Hayes, and Alan Begg. Continued thanks, as always, to Robert and David. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them in this ninth year of the podcast to support what we do financially, then please do go to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. We do hope to be back with more content next week. But in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via Twitter, Facebook or Instagram. Just search for Yes Music Podcast. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.